On the 26th of August, 1537, the son of a Putney brewer came here to St. George's Chapel in Windsor Castle to be initiated into England's highest order of chivalry by Henry VIII.
Heraldic flags hang in the church.
As the king's chief minister and now a knight of the garter, Thomas Cromwell was at the pinnacle of one of the most notorious careers in British history.
The ruins of a grand monastery.
This was the man who pillaged and destroyed hundreds of monasteries, drove a lasting wedge between England and Rome, thought nothing of betraying his friends and allies, and conspired to execute a queen, Anne Boleyn.
While he was Henry VIII's chief minister, Thomas Cromwell was the second most powerful man in England. Historians have often seen him merely as cynical, corrupt and manipulative, spreading fear and suspicion through the English court and across the nation. In many accounts, Thomas Cromwell is one of the nastiest people ever to hold power in England.
But I don't think Cromwell's dark reputation is justified. Certainly, it's not the whole story. He was a pioneering and principled statesman who set the country on the road to parliamentary democracy. A religious reformer who persuaded the king to introduce the first authorised English translation of the Bible. And he risked his own life to smuggle the radical forces of the Reformation into the English church.
I believe that Thomas Cromwell, far from being just a cynical power broker, was motivated by genuine religious zeal and a yearning to serve his country. This much maligned brewer's boy from Putney was a self-educated visionary who, in his 6 years as chief royal minister, helped to lay the foundations of the modern British state.
A painting of Thomas Cromwell with his piercing glare. Henry VIII's enforcer. The rise and fall of Thomas Cromwell. Light reflects off the shimmering waters. A chain hangs near a wall covered in lichen. Professor Dermot McCulloch walks across a pebble beach.
Thomas Cromwell was born in obscurity, here in Putney. There isn't even a record of when he was born, but the year was probably 1485.
Gulls at the water's edge.
This is Brewhouse Lane, where his family lived and ran a small brewery. It's only 6 miles up the Thames from the centre of power in Westminster, but young Thomas might as well have been a universe away.
Cromwell grew up in an England where everyone knew their place. Ordinary people looked up to an hereditary nobility.
An illustration of court.
The nobility supported a divinely appointed monarch. And even the monarch deferred to the Pope in Rome on religious matters.
A king kneels at the feet of the Pope.
Cromwell's family was near the bottom of this hierarchy. His father, Walter, was a scoundrel who always seemed to be looking for trouble.
I wouldn't have recommended drinking from Walter Cromwell's beer barrels. He ran the sort of pub you don't go to twice. And I have here some copies of the court records of the Manor of Wimbledon. And here under Putney for 17th of October 1501, I see Walter Cromwell, common brewer of beer, fine for breaking the assizes of ale. In other words, he's watering his beer. Fine 8 pence. There's another one here, Putney, Walter Cromwell, breaking the assizes of beer, 6 pence. And if you look through the rolls, there are at least 48 entries of fines for Walter Cromwell. And he's also fined for assaulting his neighbour, so he's clearly handy with his fists. I think young Thomas Cromwell had some hard lessons in life here in Putney. He later boasted to his old friend Archbishop Thomas Cranmer what a ruffian he was in his young days. He even told his eminent friends that he'd spent some time in jail. It all added to the colourful reputation.
Dermot takes a sip of his pint, gently rippling waters.
Around 1502, aged about 17 years old, with no prospects or education, Cromwell left Putney and England behind. What he did next is a bit of a mystery. The great Elizabethan historian, John Fox, reveals Cromwell serving as a mercenary in the French army, which was utterly defeated in battle against the Holy Roman Emperor. But the future politician was already developing a useful skill, making friends in high places. According to an Italian author, Cromwell popped up in Florence and somehow got employed by a wealthy financier, Francisco Frescobaldi, in one of Europe's biggest banks.
A medieval illustration of money changing hands, a beam of sunlight on the water as boats move through it.
14 years later, a very different Thomas Cromwell came back to London. Somehow, mysteriously, the Putney ruffian was now as well-educated as any Tudor nobleman in languages and the law. He was accepted into London society and was now respectable enough to marry the wealthy widow of a financier, Elizabeth. He was on his way up.
People walked through a teeming market with vegetables being sold from baskets.
Here in Boston, in Lincolnshire, Cromwell was to make his reputation as a skilled operator and fixer who could get things done. This wealthy town was controlled by trade associations of merchants called guilds. In 1517, they had a problem, and Thomas Cromwell was sent in to sort it out. The guilds had made their money from sheep's wool. But by the 16th century, most of their revenue came from a different flock, church congregations. The Boston merchants had built one of the greatest parish churches in the land. It's known locally as the Boston Stump.
The grand interior of a church with stained glass windows.
Many of the guilds had their own chapels here. The place of honour went to the richest and most powerful, the Guild of St. Mary. And it's here that they made their money. This was the Guild Chapel of the Blessed Virgin Mary in the parish church in Boston. And successive popes had granted the Guild the right to offer a special spiritual pardon, an indulgence called the Scala Coeli, the Stairway to Heaven. And it did what it says on the tin. You pay your money and the soul of your dear old deceased mother flies out of purgatory into heaven. Look, here is Pope with SC for Scala Coeli on his vestments, and this is part of a great luxury tomb which is carefully placed prime position near the altar where the guild masses are said. And there are the three seats where the priests who'd sing the mass would sit. Now, the chief wealth of the guild came from the sale of this indulgence. But in 1517, the license for the indulgence was about to expire, which threatened the guild's revenues. From their guild hall, the merchants and Cromwell hatched a plan to renew and extend the indulgence, and so save the guild. Cromwell would lead an impressive delegation on an ambitious trip to Italy to negotiate directly with Pope Leo X himself. Well, this is a copy of the guild accounts for that trip to Italy. And I see Cromwell's expenses, Calais to Rome, 3 weeks, £47. I think that's about £28,000 in our money. But then you look at the scale of the whole project. It's £1,200 they're spending on this. That's around £600,000 in modern money. And that is the mark of the trust which the merchants of Boston were placing in Thomas Cromwell.
An illustration of a medieval hunt.
Once in Rome, Cromwell set to work. Instead of observing protocol and joining the long queue of petitioners at the Vatican, he arranged a chance encounter with the head of the Roman Church. As Leo X finished a day's hunting, he came across Cromwell and his entourage. He was transfixed by the sound of English singers performing a beautiful three-note harmony. The Pope was on the hook. Now Cromwell started to reel him in. The Pope was well known for his sweet tooth, so Cromwell tempted him with various English delicacies and dainty dishes. Now, you might call them indulgences for indulgences. But the Pope granted the renewal of the licence for the guild, and their future was secure. It was a triumph for Cromwell's strategy. He had shown just what an extraordinary fixer he could be.
A frozen cobweb hangs between leaves covered in frost.
When he returned to England, Cromwell's reputation continued to grow. The man who'd successfully negotiated with the Pope was offered legal work in London and given the opportunity to sharpen his fixing skills in the city. And he soon came to the attention of the men with power and influence in the court of Henry VIII.
A statue of a golden lion wearing a crown covered in cobwebs.
Henry VIII came to the throne in 1509. He wanted all the power and glory of a great European monarch. But it quickly became apparent that he wasn't prepared to do the legwork of running the kingdom himself. What he needed was a close advisor to get things done. And he found just the man in Cardinal Thomas Wolsey, who became the king's principal minister. His cardinal's hat and initials still grace the great palace at Hampton Court, which he built, and where he kept a household to rival the king's. Cromwell was called here to serve Henry's powerful first minister. Like Cromwell, Wolsey had a humble start in life, but his intelligence and energy quickly made him the servant that Henry couldn't do without. Cromwell watched and learned. Wolsey was a self-made man of the Renaissance. On his way up, he'd benefited from an Oxford education. Now he wanted other boys from poor backgrounds to get the same opportunities. He decided to set up a college at Oxford University and a school in his hometown, Ipswich in Suffolk. Both would be named Cardinal College as a twin memorial to Wolsey. For 3 years, Cromwell had been rising through the ranks of Wolsey's household. Now he was given the chance to show that he could make things happen. As Wolsey's lawyer, Cromwell was in charge of setting up the new school and college. And to finance Ipswich School, he dissolved 12 monasteries and priories, the biggest of which was here, the Augustinian canons of St. Peter and St. Paul. And their church became the new school chapel, with a few improvements, like these Tudor roses round the door. And behind, 6 acres of buildings and fields just right for school sports.
Diarmaid goes through the heavy wooden doors.
Cromwell evicted the canons and used the wealth of the monastery to create the first Cardinal College. The school opened with a grand ceremony in this church in 1528. And this letter from the dean of the college to Wolsey describes it all. Upon Our Lady's Even, I, with all the company of your Grace's college, sung evensong as solemnly and devoutly as we could, and there accompanied by Master Cromwell. Also, all the honourable gentlemen of the shire were there, and took repast at dinner in your Grace's college, and, as I trust, were entertained with good fare.
An engraving of the college in Tudor times.
To finance Cardinal College, Oxford, Cromwell dissolved another 12 monasteries. An object lesson in what you could do with the church's wealth. He got a taste for dissolving monasteries.
An illustration of the king on his throne, with nobles and bishops around him.
Now he became fixer-in-chief to the king's fixer. In 1523, he'd been elected to Parliament as an MP, possibly with the cardinal's help. But the cardinal was fast being embroiled in the defining royal crisis of the age. It was known as the King's Great Matter. Henry had been married to Catherine of Aragon since 1509. But as she was already the widow of his elder brother Arthur, many lawyers believed the marriage to be illegal. It only went ahead after a special dispensation from the Pope. But now there was a problem. After 18 years, the marriage had only produced one living child, and that a daughter, Mary. Henry, a pious man, decided that the supposed marriage was against God's will. And he also had his eye on a lady-in-waiting, Anne Boleyn. This was a job for the cardinal. Wolsey had to persuade the Pope that the royal marriage was illegal and should be annulled. In church law, there were arguments both for and against marrying your dead brother's wife. Henry's case wasn't bad, but international politics were poisonously against him. Catherine of Aragon was very well connected. Her nephew was Emperor Charles V, the most powerful monarch in Europe. With his support, she appealed against the annulment to the Pope. Henry's cause looked hopeless. Still, Wolsey kept trying. His best shot was to find a subtle legal technicality in the original dispensation to marry. That would have saved the Pope's face if he declared the marriage void. It could have worked. But it was Henry who scuppered that plan. Playing around with legal detail wouldn't make God any less angry. Henry's new love, Anne Boleyn, taunted the king for his failure to solve the problem. And she managed to convince him that Wolsey was in league with the Pope, that he was deliberately slowing proceedings. Henry was losing faith in his cardinal.
The exterior of Hampton Court.
In 1529, Wolsey was arrested, charged with exercising a foreign authority against the king, purely because he was doing his job as the Pope's representative in England. It was hugely unfair.
A window with bare tree branches reflected in it.
Thomas Cromwell has a reputation for being selfish and treacherous, but when Wolsey fell from grace and most of his household disowned him, Cromwell stayed loyal. And at the Ipswich School, he went on to defend his patron's educational legacy, despite the personal risk. When the king threatened to destroy both cardinal colleges, Cromwell stepped in to make sure that the good folk of Ipswich still had some sort of school, even if it wasn't the mega college that Wolsey had planned. And he persuaded the king not to destroy Cardinal College, Oxford. Later, Henry renamed it Christchurch, and that's what it's still called. But they've not forgotten the cardinal there.
A stone relief of a heraldic shield on the wall.
Thomas Cromwell's own position was also in jeopardy. As a man of humble birth, he knew he was entirely dependent on the cardinal for support and career advancement. Another member of Wolsey's household, George Cavendish, described how he found Cromwell quietly crying by a window. And Cavendish asked, "Why, Master Cromwell, what meaneth all this sorrow?" "Nay, nay," replied Cromwell, "it is my unhappy adventure. I am like to lose all I have toiled for all my life for doing my master true and diligent service." Wolsey's fall meant Cromwell's fall.
Diarmaid looks out of the window.
Cromwell's future looked bleak. His wife Elizabeth died in the same year, leaving him with three children, two daughters and a lacklustre son called Gregory, who never showed a talent for anything. But a year later, the king was still searching for a solution to his great matter, and Cromwell would use this as a way to claw his way back to favour. The crisis that destroyed Wolsey now opened the door for Cromwell to show the king what a valuable operator he could be.
An old book.
The king was trying to find a way to prove that English monarchs were beyond papal authority. He'd sent researchers to libraries across the land to find evidence in support of a startling new history of the English monarchy.
Ornate pages of Latin.
And one of the chief books they used was the 12th century History of the Kings of Britain by Geoffrey of Monmouth. And it was actually a series of myths. No historian anywhere else in Europe believed Geoffrey. This is a finely decorated medieval copy. And in it, Geoffrey invents the story of King Arthur, Merlin, and the Knights of the Round Table. And here is one of those myths.
Arthur, the king of ancient Britain, was involved in an epic struggle against the Roman Empire. One of his followers reminds him of an ancient Roman prophecy.
For a third time, one born of British blood will rule the Roman state. You stand before us as the third to whom that title has been vouchsafed. In other words, King Arthur was an emperor, and so was his successor, King Henry. In fact, England was an empire, and emperors are beholden to no one, not even the Pope.
After 1,000 years of obedience to Rome, the king was asking his people to reject the papacy.
Only King Henry could have come up with this extraordinary idea. Not even Cromwell would have had the gall to rewrite European history like this. But Cromwell's unique contribution was to show the king how to sell this idea to the nobility and the rest of the English people.
Clouds roll above the Houses of Parliament.
Cromwell's proven skills as a fixer would now be deployed on behalf of the king. Thomas Cromwell was back in the game.
Cromwell knew that there was only one institution that could galvanise enough support for Henry's revolution, Parliament. By 1532, it was 9 years since he'd first sat as an MP. He knew how to work the system from the inside and how to change it.
Until now, Parliament's main role had been to pass on petitions from the people and raise taxation. Cromwell set out to persuade Parliament that it had the power to change the nature of the constitution and create laws that would destroy the Pope's power over the king.
A statue of Henry VIII.
Only Parliament could convince the people that England had always been an empire and the king an emperor, and it could pass the legislation to make the fiction a reality.
From a corridor adorned with paintings to a room full of shelves of scrolls.
All surviving Acts of Parliament since 1497 are stored here in the Parliamentary Archives at Westminster. This includes a key bill written by Thomas Cromwell. In it, he persuaded Parliament to begin the legal process of setting up the Empire of England.
This is the Act in Restraint of Appeals. It forbids legal appeals from England to Rome, and that was purely to stop Catherine of Aragon appealing to the Pope, but we're still living with the consequences. This document creates the breach between English monarchs and the papacy, and bizarrely, it justifies it through the patriotic fantasies of authors like Geoffrey of Monmouth. Now, it claims, by divers sundry old authentic histories and chronicles, it is manifestly declared and expressed that this realm of England is an empire, and so hath been accepted in the world, governed by one supreme head and king. What had once been myth was now law.
For the first time in English history, Thomas Cromwell had given Parliament the power to intervene in the most fundamental constitutional affairs of the nation. This power has never been surrendered.
Over the next few centuries, most European monarchs came to rule without their ancient parliaments, with fewer and fewer restraints on their power. But from now on, English kings and queens had to include Parliament in all the great decisions of state. Thomas Cromwell would not have understood the meaning of parliamentary democracy. But if you want to see where our democracy has come from, you start here.
Diarmaid looks down at the document.
In 1532, Cromwell was rewarded for his work by a grateful king. He was granted the honorary title Master of the Jewels and invited to enter the royal court.
A portrait of Cromwell.
This portrait of Cromwell, painted in 1533 by Hans Holbein, shows a serious and attentive man. His determination to transform the relationship between church and state was motivated by much more than just a desire to please the king.
Cromwell peers into the distance. An engraving of people in a frenzy.
At this time, a religious revolution was sweeping through Europe. The Reformation.
A cleric writes on a church door.
It had been ignited by the German cleric Martin Luther. And it would overturn centuries of Christian belief.
Diarmaid walks through a church.
Luther's followers called themselves evangelicals because they turned to the Gospels, Evangelia in Latin. They sought a simpler Christianity based on God's word in the Bible, and they rejected any other church teaching as superstition. They said, away with the wealth and corruption of the church hierarchy, and that threatened the power of the Pope, political as well as religious.
Merchants from Germany and the Low Countries were among the first to bring the ideas that fueled the Reformation in England.
It's highly likely that Cromwell was introduced to Protestantism here in Boston. And that turning point didn't just change his life, it transformed the future of this country.
The king on his throne.
In 1533, Cromwell was starting to reveal his reformist credentials. And he found a growing number of powerful evangelical allies in the royal court. Cromwell's most important ally was the new queen-in-waiting, Anne Boleyn. In 1533, she persuaded the king to appoint an obscure clergyman, Thomas Cranmer, as Archbishop of Canterbury. He was another evangelical reformer. Immediately, he agreed to annul Henry's marriage to Catherine. 5 days later, he married the king to Anne Boleyn. Both the king and his chief minister were getting what they wanted.
Cromwell had now made sure that the king was recognised as supreme head of the Church of England, with power to determine all religious matters. That same year, Cromwell was promoted again to be the king's principal secretary. Only Henry himself had more political power.
The Houses of Parliament lie across the River Thames.
And he was given new powers over the church and its monasteries. He knew from dissolving monasteries for Cardinal Wolsey that they were a source of great wealth.
The ruins of a monastery.
Places like Hales Abbey in Gloucestershire had dominated people's lives for centuries. Their combined annual income was double that of the king's own estates. And they were influential centres of papal power. Cromwell could now raise vast revenues for Henry and advance his own evangelical agenda in a single stroke.
This monastery was once one of the greatest pilgrimage centres of the West Country because it housed the Shrine of the Holy Blood of Christ. And look at these foundations, an extraordinary ring of five chapels so that crowds of pilgrims could come down the north side, hear a mass, and then out the south side.
They had come to see the blood of Christ, said to have been taken as he died on the cross. Verified by the Pope himself, the relic was displayed in a 2-foot-high shrine which stood on this mound.
What I've got here is one of the souvenir brochures that you'd have bought in Hales in the 1520s. It's actually got the precious blood on the front cover in its little glass display case being opened by angels. And when you open it up, there are the stories of all the miracles done at the shrine. And my favourite is John Marshall and his mates. They were merchants who'd been miraculously released from prison in France at Mont-Saint-Michel. So they came here to give thanks. And it's the ending which is so good, because they went in procession round the church, and then it says, the men had little to spend when they had offered up with good devotion their candles that they had borne in procession. You see the point that you come here, you leave as much money as possible in offerings.
In return, the pilgrims were assured by the church that their eternal soul's entry into heaven would be guaranteed. Reformers like Cromwell saw these relics as unholy and superstitious, and another form of church corruption.
So evangelicals would not just see this shrine as an abomination, they would also see the wealth that had been produced by the likes of John Marshall.
Cromwell wanted to discredit the monasteries. In 1538, he sent the holy blood to be examined. After centuries of veneration, it was then publicly denounced as honey clarified and coloured with saffron. A year later, the monastery at Hales was closed down. Overall, Cromwell was responsible for dissolving up to 800 monasteries and religious houses across England and Wales. Their wealth poured into the royal coffers.
A map of England, then the dilapidated stone arches of a ruined monastery.
Many people have never forgiven Thomas Cromwell for the dissolution of the monasteries. He's often portrayed as a mindless thug, trashing the Catholic Church and looting the monasteries simply for material gain.
But he was also proving himself to be a committed religious reformer, driven by deeply held principle.
He closed the monasteries to end what he saw as the superstitious practices and corruption of the church. And he made sure that the monks got pensions. The buildings themselves had various fates, stripped of anything valuable, yes, but sometimes deliberately left as ruins, just to show that the Reformation had won.
An illustration with a sign reading, "The Temple Well Purged."
The dissolution of the monasteries will be remembered as Cromwell's most destructive act. His radical reforms reveal the king's fixer-in-chief to be both evangelical reformer and merciless politician.
There's no denying that Cromwell's politics could get dirty and ruthless. He fell out with his evangelical ally, Queen Anne Boleyn. They clashed bitterly because she wanted the money from the monasteries used for good causes rather than filling the king's coffers.
But the queen was losing her value as an ally. After 3 years of marriage, Henry had fallen out of love with her. When she miscarried her second child, he decided Anne wasn't going to produce his longed-for son, and now he wanted to discard her. Cromwell was only too willing to help by intimidating those nearest to her. He even tortured false confessions out of them.
He cooked up evidence for Anne's treason and incest with her own brother. And so Anne was beheaded, leaving the king to marry the latest beauty who'd caught his eye, Jane Seymour. This does seem to me to be the darkest deed of the man. It's good evidence for the prosecution.
Cromwell is always remembered for conspiring to kill a queen and looting the monasteries. And this has overshadowed the legacy of his evangelical principles and statesmanship. For Cromwell was also a great defender of what was known as the common weal. You might say public good.
Monasteries like Hales had been served by lay brothers who lived in this West Range here, but also had a swarm of other servants. The dissolution just added to an already growing problem of homelessness and unemployment right across the realm. This was new and frightening. And the growing poverty also offended Cromwell's evangelical ideals. So he set up a sort of think tank of young reformers to dream up ideas for improving the common weal. With their help, he was able to bring a parliamentary bill to require local communities to force able-bodied homeless beggars to work.
Well, it was tough love, but you might see it as coming from a man of principle who'd started with nothing, got on his bike and made it, and was now determined that the state should look after the poor.
Cromwell's Act was the first step towards a comprehensive poor law plan, which was finally passed in 1597 by an Elizabethan parliament.
This national system of poor relief was not replaced until the 19th century. You might not like the sound of it, but you can't deny that Thomas Cromwell showed the way to a new kind of welfare state.
The stone arches beneath the dusty sky. Then Diarmid walks through the dark interior of a church with a flashlight.
Cromwell's evangelical convictions have also had a long-lasting, unforeseen impact on our ideas of public morality.
Shining the flashlight, he looks up at the images of saints.
He regarded the monasteries as centres of homosexuality. And so, as part of his campaign against the monasteries, he persuaded Parliament to pass an act for the punishment of the vice of buggery.
The handwritten script on the act.
The act was no more than 16 lines long, but it represented the first time that the state had tried to control private sexual behaviour or morality. Before that, the church had a monopoly on deciding what was moral or immoral. Now, Cromwell had paved the way to a huge extension of state power, and the results are still at the heart of our politics.
A doorway with ornate gold decorations and a large Tudor rose above it.
Here at St John's College, Cambridge, we can see further evidence that Thomas Cromwell was more than just a cynical manipulator. It proves that he was prepared to risk his hard-won place at the side of the king to follow his principles and take England down the path of evangelical Protestantism.
Diarmid climbs some stairs.
Of course, the very term evangelical means getting back to the gospel. But the Bible in use in Henry's England was still in Latin, and you need education to understand Latin. So the Bible wasn't there for ordinary people to read, it was there for clergy to interpret for them. Evangelicals demanded that the Bible should be in English so that everyone could read the Word of God for themselves. It was a revolutionary idea at the time, and it was certainly a step too far for King Henry.
There had been various efforts to translate the Bible into English. The most successful was by William Tyndale. But Henry hated the idea of translation. He forced Tyndale into exile and colluded in his arrest and execution as a heretic in 1536. Despite Tyndale's fate, Thomas Cromwell had the courage to stick his neck out, though it must be said that his timing was perfect. Henry had just married Jane Seymour, and she was pregnant with what he hoped was the longed-for male heir.
Henry was in generous mood, and Cromwell seized the moment. He took the enormous risk of giving the king a copy of the Bible in English, and within 10 days, Henry had approved it, one of the greatest royal U-turn of the reign. And now Cromwell had the opportunity. He issued an order that every parish in the land should get a copy of the Bible in English. And in St John's College Library in Cambridge, there it is, Thomas Cromwell's own copy.
And this great title page is like a Tudor strip cartoon of what's just happened, because we've got King Henry as supreme head of the Church of England on his throne. I notice he's rather bigger than the figure of God above him. And he's handing out copies of the English Bible on the one hand to Archbishop Cranmer and the bishops, and on the other to Thomas Cromwell.
And Cranmer then hands the English Bible to his clergy below. Thomas Cromwell hands a copy to lay people in England. Now, the clergy have got to preach the message of obedience to King Henry out of the Bibles, and the congregations have got the message because they're all shouting loyally, Vivat Rex, Vivat Rex, except for one little boy down here who hasn't learned his Latin, so he loyally shouts, God save the king. And then, in the corner, is a little dark note, because it's a prison, and in the prison are all the people who don't listen to King Henry's Bible, either because they're papists or because they're Protestants who have gone too far. With a copy of the Bible in English in every parish church, everyone now had the chance of reading the Bible in their own language. Cromwell had cemented the great divide between the Church of England and the Church of Rome.
Clouds roll above the mountains, then snow tops the roofs of houses in a quaint old European city.
But Cromwell didn't stop there. He was prepared to risk his own life for the evangelical cause.
Diarmaid walks through the snowy streets with a clock tower looming above.
His greatest contribution to reforming the Church of England started in Switzerland. As the Reformation swept through Europe, Martin Luther was joined by other, more radical voices. One of the most extreme lived here in Zurich. He was called Huldrych Zwingli.
A statue of the man carrying a large sword. Inside a church.
Zwingli was pastor of Zurich's greatest church, the Großmünster. And like Luther in Germany, he preached against the corruption of the Pope and his church. Zwingli went one step further. He rejected the church's teaching on the most sacred Christian ceremony, the Mass. Catholics believe that in the Mass, bread and wine become the living body and blood of Jesus Christ. Zwingli said they didn't.
The layout of the Großmünster demonstrates his beliefs. Zwingli removed the high altar, where the transformation of the bread and wine traditionally took place, and replaced it with a table in the middle of the church, among the people.
That's because Zwingli's church celebrated not a Mass, but a Holy Communion. The bread and wine were purely a sacred sign that Christ died for all our sins. They are not the body and blood of Christ, but remain bread and wine still. It's difficult in our secular age to imagine the fury that this unleashed in the 16th century. Henry VIII thought it the worst sort of blasphemy. He burned at the stake people who had taken up Zwingli's ideas in England.
Until this time, England had no official connections with Switzerland. But this changed in 1537, when a group of talented young Oxford graduates arrived at this house in Zurich to meet Zwingli's successor, Heinrich Bullinger. They seemed to be an official delegation from the Church of England.
Diarmaid looks out of a window.
But who really sent them? Certainly not the king. And Archbishop Cranmer, if anything, shared Henry's opinion that Zwingli was a heretic. But all the Oxford visitors had close links to Cromwell. Only Cromwell had both the power and the motivation to authorise a mission like this. And the link to Zurich would make sure that the breach between Rome and England would never be healed.
I am certain that Thomas Cromwell had accepted Zwingli's radical reformist teaching. He knew the king wouldn't change his mind about the Mass, and that if his Swiss connections were discovered, he would be burned as a heretic. But ever the strategist, Cromwell was playing a long game. The Oxford graduates returned to England as devout and determined Protestants, evangelical time bombs in the Church of England.
At the altar, a priest breaks a wafer.
We break this bread to share in the body of Christ.
5 years after Henry's death, the Church of England adopted Zwingli's symbolic interpretation of Holy Communion. This theological revolution, which enshrined the divide between England and Rome, is Thomas Cromwell's greatest legacy.
the opulent Gothic interior of the church. Dearmaid walks past a grand building with Windsor Castle in the distance.
Cromwell must have felt unstoppable.
Ornate windows and statues on ledges. The interior is lit with lamps.
He'd already been well rewarded with wealth and property. And now his great patron was to give him a prize no money could buy. Social status.
Arched ceilings.
St. George's Chapel, Windsor, is the mother chapel of the most ancient and honourable of the English chivalric orders, the Knighthood of the Garter.
Rows of brightly coloured heraldic flags hanging from above.
Only 24 people, personally chosen by the monarch, can hold the honour at any one time.
One of them has a Union Jack and red lions on it.
To this day, the banners of the knights hang high in this chapel, and you see the great families of the realm. There, the Duke of Westminster, there, the Duke of Wellington, and below them, their helms, complete with family crests.
In 1537, Henry invited the publican son from Putney to join this noble circle. He created Cromwell a Knight of the Garter. The upstart had used royal patronage to force his way into this rigid hierarchy. Many people would have been satisfied with this honour, but not Thomas Cromwell. This is the stall in which Thomas Cromwell eventually took his place as Knight of the Garter. On it is a plaque. It's for Henry Busher, Earl of Essex. Henry Busher was the holder of one of the most ancient titles in England, but he died without an heir. The king took the opportunity to bestow this earldom on his chief minister, who now became Earl of Essex.
Thomas Cromwell had now joined the hereditary nobility. Intelligence and ruthless determination had brought him huge wealth and great status. He must have felt invincible. But the political skill and evangelical drive which had taken Thomas Cromwell so far would also tear him down.
In 1537, Jane Seymour, Henry's third wife, had died just after giving birth to Edward, the long-awaited heir. Now the king was in need of another wife.
A portrait of Jane Seymour.
Cromwell came here to Archbishop Cranmer's country palace at Croydon to perform his fixer's magic one more time. He wanted to arrange a marriage for the king which would ally England with the forces of the Reformation. He hoped to enlist the Archbishop's support in persuading Henry to marry a German princess, Anne of Cleves. But the Archbishop wasn't convinced.
This manuscript is a 17th century summary of a lost contemporary account of the conversation between Cranmer and Cromwell. And it's a fascinating glimpse into the relationship between these two most powerful men in Tudor England. And Cranmer, ever mindful of King Henry's happiness, bless him, said that he thought it most expedient the king to marry where that he had his fantasy and love, for that would be most comfort for his grace. And Cromwell, furious at this political naivety, snapped back that there was none meet for him within this realm. And Cranmer replied that it would be very strange to be married with her that he could not talk with. In other words, speak English too.
A single lit candle.
Anne of Cleves might not speak much English, but Cromwell was determined to show the king she possessed other virtues. He dispatched his favourite artist, Hans Holbein, to paint a portrait of the 24-year-old German princess.
A tiny portrait of Anne of Cleves.
Well, this is rather lovely, isn't it? This is the actual miniature which Hans Holbein sent to England. So you and I are in the same position as King Henry, viewing his bride-to-be. Portraits of this date would often have the face slightly turned away, but this is full face, so that he could be sure there were no blemishes. And the headdress is painted to be in the English fashion, not the German style she'd have actually worn, so that the king could compare her with the ladies he knew.
Standards of beauty do change over time, but we can be pretty sure that the king saw a beautiful lady staring back at him. So he agreed to Cromwell's choice.
Diarmaid rushes upstairs.
A great ceremony for Henry to meet Anne was planned for January the 3rd, 1540, but the king couldn't wait and impatiently rushed off 3 days early to surprise her.
Henry burst into his future wife's chambers, but the king didn't like what he saw. The princess failed to live up to her painted image. When Henry got back to London, he rounded on Cromwell. "Is there no remedy but that against my will I must put my neck in the yoke?" And the wedding night only compounded his misery. He said to Cromwell, "I liked her before not well, but now I like her much worse." The management of royal marriages and annulments had been the making of Cromwell. This one would prove to be his unmaking.
There was no longer any need to appeal to the Pope for this annulment. Instead, Henry, the supreme head of the Church of England, was required to appear in a church court in front of his subjects and present intimate evidence of his failure to consummate the wedding night.
For a proud monarch who gloried in his virility, to be forced into a public admission of impotence was a dreadful humiliation. Henry needed someone to blame. Cromwell fell from the king's favour, and he had such a long way to fall. He was a self-made man with no noble ancient lineage. Without the king's patronage, he was nothing. Cromwell had seen what had happened to Thomas Wolsey. He could have tried to retrieve the situation, but Cromwell couldn't stop himself.
From below, the stone archway of the ruined monastery. Cloudy blue skies above. The remains of stone walls.
The priory here at Thetford in Norfolk was the scene of Thomas Cromwell's worst act of self-destruction. It was one of the last monasteries remaining in England, and that's because it had been protected by one of the most influential figures at the royal court, Thomas Howard, Duke of Norfolk.
This was the great church of the priory. We've just got one pillar standing to full height to show you how grand it all was. In a chapel over there was the tomb of the first Howard, Duke of Norfolk. And in front of the high altar here is one of the main vaults which housed the bodies of the earls and dukes of Norfolk and their families. This was a very special place for a very important noble family.
The stone ruins are flecked with snow.
In 1539, the Duke of Norfolk tried to save the priory from dissolution. He lobbied the king for it to be converted into a secular college, which would preserve the sanctity of the family tombs.
Thomas Cromwell was determined that it should all be destroyed. He let his evangelical zeal overcome his political nous. On the 16th of February 1540, the prior was forced to surrender his monastery. It was one of the last two to be dissolved in all England. There would be no college. Eventually, the Norfolks were forced to dig up and move the bones of their ancestors. It was the ultimate humiliation.
A castle in the distance.
The Duke of Norfolk returned to his family castle at Framlingham in Suffolk. He would rebury the remains of his ancestors in the local parish church. He was already plotting his revenge.
Beneath pale white skies, the imposing church tower.
Throughout the 1530s, Cromwell's enemies had resented his extraordinary rise, but the king's patronage meant that they were powerless to stop him. Now, Henry was smarting from the fiasco of the Cleves marriage, while the whole nobility would loathe Cromwell parading around with the ancient title of Earl of Essex. The desecration of Thetford Priory had now infuriated the Duke of Norfolk. Lying here next to his wife is the man who was determined to destroy the mighty First Minister.
Cromwell knew better than most that the king had always been easily swayed by those closest to him. Now it was the Duke of Norfolk who whispered in Henry's ear.
The king was easily persuaded that his chief minister was a heretic and a traitor. On the 10th of June, 1540, Cromwell was attending the king's council. The Duke of Norfolk strode up to him and said, "Cromwell, do not sit there. That is no place for you. Traitors do not sit amongst gentlemen." Cromwell replied, "I am no traitor." Then the Duke himself tore the insignia of the Garter from Cromwell's neck. That's for Thetford Priory. The chief minister was arrested and taken straight to the Tower of London.
The Tower of London looms behind him.
Cromwell's enemies had waited years to strike. Within a week, the House of Lords passed a bill of attainder, stripping him of his rights and property, and accusing him of treason, heresy, and corruption. Cromwell made one final attempt to work his magic on the king.
Sitting in the Tower of London, Cromwell wrote the king one last letter, and this is a copy of it in his own handwriting. And he says, "Consider that I am a most woeful prisoner, and the death when it shall please God and you." What he's asking is, what sort of death? Burning, beheading, hanging, drawing, and quartering? And then he goes on, "And yet the frail flesh inciteth me continually to call on your grace for mercy and pardon." And then pathetic postscript. "Most gracious prince, I cry for mercy, mercy, mercy." And the signature, Thomas Cromwell. Cromwell would have expected to see the king one last time, and then he could look him in the face and persuade him to save him. But it was not to be.
Henry did show some mercy. He ordered that his former principal minister should simply be beheaded.
On 28th of July, 1540, on Tower Hill, in front of a large crowd, Thomas Cromwell walked to the block. He asked the axe man, "Pray, if possible, cut off my head with one blow so that I may not suffer." But the man botched the job. It took several blows. One account suggests that he hacked away for up to 30 minutes.
An engraving of the beheading with the executioner's axe raised into the air and throngs of people in the crowd behind.
Cromwell's head was displayed on a pike on London Bridge. His body was buried here in the chapel of St. Peter ad Vincula, inside the tower, the graveyard of traitors. It was yards away from the tomb of Anne Boleyn, the woman he had made sure died as a traitor, just like him.
King Henry on a golden throne, flanked by the clergy.
Within months, Henry was lamenting the death of the most faithful servant he ever had. But it's Cromwell's reputation as a ruthless thug that has endured for centuries.
Cromwell stands by the king's side.
Thomas Cromwell was a supreme politician and a ruthless operator who didn't shrink from using violence to achieve his ends. But we should also think of him as a great statesman and man of principle. He used his talent to cut England off from 1,000 years of Roman obedience, forge a religious revolution, and lay down the foundations for our constitutional monarchy. This pub landlord's son from Putney reshaped our history for good. Not just a thug, not just even a Protestant thug. I give you Thomas Cromwell, remaker of this realm.
Cromwell's intense gaze.